Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Take one mild-mannered economist, add $600 billion in new money, stir the pot with near-universal criticism, and what you get is Ben Bernanke, defender of the Fed. Bernanke told the world and Congress today to put up or shut up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as online savings account and money market account. Learn more at AllyBank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, gang. It is the 19th of November. Ben Bernanke is over in Germany today. There's a big conference of central bankers going on over there. And in a speech this morning, Mr. Bernanke gave about as good as he's been getting. Ever since the Federal Reserve announced its plans to buy up $600 billion in Treasury bonds as a way to keep the economy going, complaints about it have been mounting. Actually, they've gone way past complaints. The German finance minister even called Bernanke's plan, quantitative easing, clueless. Today, Bernanke made it very clear what he thinks about what the rest of the world thinks about him. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Central bankers are usually a pretty measured lot, especially on the world stage. But in his strongest words yet, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke made it clear today that global recovery won't happen without a strong U.S. economy. And that means fostering growth and tackling unemployment here at home.
The United States runs the risk of seeing millions of workers unemployed or underemployed for many years. As a society, we should find that outcome unacceptable.
The Fed has been under fire for a $600 billion bond buying spree. The intent is to stimulate the American economy. Foreign banks have accused the Fed of intentionally trying to drive down the value of the dollar and boost the market for U.S. exports. Morris Davis at the University of Wisconsin says what the world thinks isn't what's most important.
The nice thing about having your own currency is you can do what you want with it.
Bernanke's speech was delivered in Germany, but it was meant for U.S. ears, too. Bill Cheney is chief economist at John Hancock Financial.
Bernanke is clearly talking both to a foreign audience and to a domestic audience. And part of the message to the domestic audience is that he is concerned about U.S. inflation and U.S. unemployment, and that's why he's doing what he's doing.
Cheney says we'll know in the next few months if the Fed's policy is working and whether Bernanke can take a break from taking punches. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We've been telling you for quite a while now about companies that took to hoarding cash when the economy turned bad. Now that things are improving for some of those companies, they are trying to give shareholders some return on their investments. Today, for instance, the country's biggest maker of computer networking gear, Cisco Systems, added as much as $10 billion to its stock buyback program. So when a company buys up its own stock, the shares that remain outstanding are supposed to be worth more, right? But our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, explains things don't always work out that way.
Companies have used stock repurchase plans for decades now to keep share prices from sinking too low. Cisco, for example, has already bought up more than $65 billion worth of its own shares in the past decade, but the stock's value isn't far from where it was then. Critics say buybacks are often unsuccessful in raising share values. At the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, Professor William Lozonik says when they do work, they artificially inflate the price. He says they don't increase a company's true value with new products and business or boost the economy with more jobs.
Here we have all these companies obsessed, basically, with keeping their stock prices up and seeing the best thing that they can do with their money is spend billions of dollars on stock. And my view of that is any company that says that they have nothing to better do with their money, the CEO should be fired.
Market commentator and venture capitalist Peter Cohen agrees. He says executives have a duty to innovate and grow profits into the future, but buybacks actually help their own short-term bottom lines.
Managers get compensated usually on earnings per share. And if you reduce the number of shares by buying back stock, what you do is you end up boosting the earnings per share, and then that helps managers make their bonuses.
Cisco executives have also promised to issue the company's first shareholder dividend around 1 or 2% in the near future. Michael Gumport of the research firm MG Holdings says his studies show that's a more effective way to reward loyal shareholders.
Dividends distribute cash to shareholders. Stock buybacks distribute cash to former shareholders.
He says that's because shareholders need to sell a company's stock to benefit from a buyback. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a long, slow climb back to positive ground. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We learned this week there is still essentially no inflation in the American economy. Food prices in particular are flat or even falling. Photographer Jonathan Blaustein captures the value of what we eat economically and to some degree nutritionally in a collection called The Value of a Dollar. So today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, portraits, you could say, of a dollar's worth of any given food. Jonathan, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Why these pictures of food? It is, we should say, for those who haven't seen it yet, it's food in its natural state. It's just a pile of flour, some blueberries. I mean, they're very straight-ahead shots.
I'm very passionate about food. I've been cooking in my home and professionally once for 15 years. There's an old writer's adage. I studied writing as well that says, you know, write what you know. So I felt like food as a symbol set, as a sort of visual language, was a great way to talk about ideas.
Was there something that kicked you off? Did you see something and said, I wonder how much a dollar that costs and what it would look like?
Absolutely. I started shooting in the spring of 2008, but in the fall of 2007, the ideas started percolating about fast food, actually. And the way my medium, you know, my method of expression, photography, is used by advertising, you know, the industry and by corporations to sort of sell an image that doesn't exist. So I was thinking, you know, primarily about fast food, you know, hamburgers, Big Macs, and the images that we see on billboards. Everybody in America knows that the burger doesn't look like that. So the thought I had as an artist and a thinker was, wouldn't it be interesting to see what it actually looks like? To just go to the store, buy it, set it down on my table, which happens to be white, in my studio, which happens to be white, and just look at it and then photograph it.
You did more than just meat and flour and all this. I mean, you did some price point comparison. You got, I think there's one shot of 10 blueberries, 10 organic blueberries.
Correct.
Which I read someplace in a comment you had made. The resonance of a dime for every blueberry kind of struck you.
Yeah, well, a lot of this project was really about shopping. It was about consuming. You know, shopping is the American way. So 6 weeks before I bought these California early season, you know, first of the year June blueberries for a dollar, I bought 17 organic blueberries from Chile for a dollar. Chile's 6,000 miles away. So the blueberries, you know, they're superfood. Anyone will tell you that there are a few things you can eat that are better for you, you know, than a perfect blueberry. But they're not affordable for so many people. I mean, it's like a luxury item. The fact that healthy food has become a luxury item in many ways, I think, is something I'm trying to draw people's attention to.
Well, you know, it's funny because a couple of clicks down from those blueberries, you've got a stack of ramen noodles. I mean, there's seven of them sitting there in a pile, and it's there, you know, it's a dollar's worth of ramen noodles, which is a lot of ramen noodles.
It is. And, you know, ramen noodles are about as calorie dense a food as there is. I mean, everyone, when I show those pictures, everyone laughs and says, oh, man, I got through college on that.
Right, right.
And I met somebody recently who told me that she, you know, a single mom who raised four kids by herself. And she told me that that was how she did it. Huh. That because ramen noodles had that much, you know, energy in them per price, she just fed her kids ramen all the time because that's all she could afford. And, you know, ironically, I went back to Super Save the other day to buy a pack of ramen noodles. I brought them to New York with me just because I thought we'd end up talking about it. And there were five for a dollar.
Oh,
I'm in the same store in 2010. So even ramen had become more expensive in just a couple of years. It's, people can't get a break, right?
Jonathan Blaustein is the photographer behind the Value of a Dollar project. These are some pretty cool pictures. We've got them on our website as well. It's marketplace.org. Jonathan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. I really appreciate your time.
Given the all news, all the time nature of the world that we live in, It's nice every now and then to be able to slow down and try to figure out what it all means. Our stab at that is something we call the weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. And here to help us out on this Friday in November, we've got Heidi Moore with us. She writes for Deal Book at the New York Times. Also, John Carney from CNBC and his blog NetNet. John, Heidi, good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Glad to be here.
So here we have John Carney, Mr. Bernanke, sort of going toe-to-toe with the politicians in Washington. What do you think?
I thought it was pretty gutsy for him to, you know, stand up not just to Washington, but to critics all around the world today. He sort of pointed the finger and said, you know, you guys are saying we're devaluing the dollar, but the reason why the dollar was so high in the first place is because people have been afraid of what's going on in European sovereign debt, and so they've been selling all your currency all along.
Is it going to do any good, though, Heidi? I mean, are people going to stop criticizing the Fed because Ben Bernanke says cut it out?
Yeah, well, I mean, his feistiness is great, but there's actually something beneath it. It's more of kind of a Howard Beale, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore kind of moment for him. If you really look at what he's communicating, which is that he's at the end of his rope. He's used everything that he can to fix what he can in the economy. And he expressed some concern about unemployment and its connection to interest rates. He doesn't think that he can do more without Congress pitching in a little bit. He wants China to pick up some slack. It's like your mom when she said, listen, I'm not going to do everything around here. Somebody pitch in. And that's where Ben Bernanke is.
So, John, let me ask you this, though. Does it, this politicization of the Fed, I mean, it's not all Bernanke's fault, right? I mean, Congress is piling on and a lot of people are piling on the Fed. But does the fact that monetary policy now is getting so wrapped up in the politics of the moment, does that diminish what Bernanke's trying to do?
I think actually what Bernanke is trying to say is the reason why monetary policy has become so politicized is because the Congress and the rest of the branches of government, the elected branches of government, aren't actually doing their job. They're not doing very much to address unemployment, to address the economic slump that continues despite the technical end of the recession. And basically, they're leaving it up to Ben Bernanke. So he's saying, I haven't politicized monetary policy. You guys have by not doing your jobs.
What about this thought, though, Heidi, that what we have here is, and bear with me with the exaggeration, an academic economist from Princeton University who spent his life in economic policy papers trying to fight it out on political turf with guys who bring guns to knife fights?
Anyone who's been in an academic department will tell you that they are better politicians than anything you will find in Washington. And the same goes for Bernanke. He is a very skilled politician and has been since he took the post. He's managed up very well, right? He has the support of the president. He manages with his reasonable academic attitude to win people over to his side and to distance himself, which is a very political thing, from inconvenient positions and inconvenient situations. And that's why Bernanke and Tim Geithner are not as close as they once were, right? I mean, Treasury and the Fed used to be very close, and that's not the case as much anymore. So I think he's actually got the right tools for this, and it's just amazing to see him use them. He's always been so quiet and so retiring.
Yeah. So basically what he did this morning, John, and what he's been doing for the past couple of weeks is what Jennifer Collins was talking about up at the top of the broadcast. He is now calling on Congress to get its act together, in essence. Is he going to get any traction there?
I think it could backfire. The more Bernanke sort of tries to press Congress, the more I expect Congress will press back. We're in this dangerous position where the Fed wants to assert its independence and its ability to act autonomously without interference in politics. But the more he sort of is seen putting pressure on Congress, the more congressmen are going to start saying, you know what, this goes both ways, buddy. And they're going to politicize monetary policy even more than it has been.
John Carney from CNBC. Heidi Moore, she contributes to Deal Book at The New York Times. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up.
I started teaching in 1973, and you pretty much went in the classroom and you just learned to teach.
My, how times have changed. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street faded early but finished strong on this Friday. The Dow Industrials gained 22 points, about 0.2%, closed at 11,203. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ ticked up 3 points, 0.1%, 25.18 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 3 points, 0.25%. ended things at 1199. For the week gone by, the Dow eked out a gain of less than a 0.1%. The NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 broke even, but barely. Tech stocks flexed their muscles today. Salesforce.com, that's a company that designs software for cloud computing, saw its shares pierce the cloud. Strong earnings sent its stock up 18%. Hewlett-Packard gained 1.9% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. By the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The LA Auto Show revs up in downtown Los Angeles. Will you spend more or less this year to get stuff under the tree? The Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association released their annual survey on holiday spending plans. Annie directed Brazil and The Fisher King, among many others. Monty Python's Terry Gilliam turns 70. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so the rest of the college football season pretty much breaks down like this. If Oregon and Auburn can stay undefeated, ranked number 1 and 2 in the country, they're going to meet for the national championship in January. If that happens, you're going to be hearing the name Cam Newton a whole lot more. He's the quarterback at Auburn. His name's being tossed around as a possible Heisman Trophy winner for one thing, but the NCAA, as it happens, is investigating exactly how Newton came to be playing at Auburn in the first place. There are some questions about whether his dad asked for cold hard cash before his son signed on. The general state of play in college athletics has commentator John Wertheim thinking.
Once upon a time, the labor market in big-time college sports worked relatively well. Athletes were amateurs and therefore couldn't be paid for their services, but they received a full scholarship. And in return, the school used their services to fill up the bleachers and make some extra revenue if the sports teams did well. Fair enough. Yet today, schools have turned their athletic departments into mini-industrial complexes, flush with licensing deals, conference television networks, and BCS and Final Four appearances that generate tens of millions in revenue. And athletes in those big-money sports are finding that an undergraduate degree is worth less than it was a generation ago. True, they have no student loans, and countless other kids and their families are rightfully envious of this four-year free ride. Still, it's hard to dispute that the labor market in college sports hasn't become distorted. Star athletes are dramatically underpaid relative to the value they create. It's a fundamental of economics. When industries are regulated and markets don't work freely, there will be corrections. We see this with the thriving black market in communist countries. We see this with tax loopholes. And college sports are subject to this principle as well. Tell athletes who generate millions for their school that their compensation must be capped at the value of their scholarship, and there will be attempts to correct this inefficiency. So you see stories of athletes and their families trying to get more, of middlemen trying to grease the skids, of alumni, sometimes even the schools themselves, meeting the asking price. Distasteful as it may seem to some of us, athletes seeking to correct a distorted labor market are simply acting rationally. The NCAA will investigate each affair and express shock and outrage at these unseemly incidents, but the economics professors at the NCAA's member schools, they're surely less surprised, because they know better.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. You can send us your comments, sporting or not. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. We're We're going to go back to Monroe, Louisiana now and pick up with Marketplace's Amy Scott where we left off yesterday with one of the toughest questions in education today. How to make good teachers. There are more than 1,200 college and university departments in this country that churn out new teachers every year. And by a lot of accounts, many of them aren't up to the job. Amy told us yesterday how the state of Louisiana has redesigned its teacher training programs by making future teachers spend more time with actual kids before they take charge of the classroom. Today, she has sort of the opposite approach.
Remember high school chemistry class? Think basement lab, no windows, a couple of kids spaced out in the back. The teacher in the front is trying to get across something about density.
Someone raise their hand and tell me why the density of that gas would be less than, say, a solid, like gold.
Do we need to write these down?
So now that you raise your hand, Bradley, why do you think the density of this gas...
Karari Hanks has only been at this a few years, teaching chemistry at Neville High School in Monroe, Louisiana. But according to the state, new teachers like Hanks are as effective as experienced teachers, if not more so. Hanks came out of a fast-track teacher training program at the University of Louisiana at Monroe. Instead of following the traditional path, spending 4 years earning a bachelor's degree in education, students who already have a degree start teaching right away while working on their master's. Many are career changers, like Hanks.
I was a project manager for an environmental consulting firm in Atlanta, Georgia. And my wife and I moved here because we had a baby and wanted to get closer to family. I could not find a job for 6 months. And found out they needed a science teacher here, so it was sort of a no-brainer for me.
A decade ago, Louisiana forced its teacher training programs to retool. ULM and others created the fast-track programs, and the state started assessing whether the students of those fast-track teachers made progress on standardized tests. George Noel of LSU leads the annual study. He says teachers coming out of the University of Louisiana at Monroe's master's program have consistently fared well.
Generally, across content areas, they produced results that were better than typical new teachers and more comparable to or more similar to experienced teachers.
The question is, why? One theory is the candidates. Monroe sits at the edge of the Mississippi Delta region, a rural area with high poverty and few jobs. ULM has a federal grant to help get more qualified teachers in the area. The grant pays for a recruiter, Dewana Greer, to hunt for talent.
Generally, we look for recent college graduates or people who have probably been in other industries, banking, insurance, engineering, whatever, and now they've decided that they kind of want to teach.
They can't just kind of want to teach. Candidates have to shell out several hundred dollars for testing just to get into the program.
They've made the choice to come to us. And as a result of that, if you want to do something, then I think it yields a better candidate and ultimately a better teacher.
Once they sign up, they get plenty of help. Outside Carroll High School in Monroe, the drumline rehearses for competition. Inside, one of the district's newest teachers is doing some practicing of his own.
Okay, and I loved the video clip of La Bamba. That was great.
Alberto Sandino gets feedback on his teaching from longtime teacher Mary Rainey. Sandino is a former banker. He's working on his master's at ULM while teaching high school Spanish full-time. Four times a semester, Rainey watches him teach a class, then they discuss.
This allows her to give me feedback on the areas that I need to improve and just to help me become a better educator.
Rainey taught for 33 years. She's not surprised that graduates of the program do as well as many experienced teachers.
I started teaching in 1973, and there was not all of this process. You know, you pretty much went in the classroom and you just learned to teach on your own. You didn't have anybody to really work with you.
ULM's isn't the only alternative program in the state that's had good results. Luke Thomas is former dean of ULM's College of Education. He says that raises questions about the traditional undergraduate path to teaching, where college students spend hundreds of hours practicing before they take charge of a classroom.
If this fast-track program is working that well, I mean, that would change the whole dynamics of a college of education.
And show again that there's more than one way to teach teachers. In Monroe, Louisiana, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. By the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt, it's more car than electric. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on a Friday afternoon, a chance to escape the heavy-duty news of the week and touch on what didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Delasi Michalis, web developer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, these six poker buddies in Texas wanted to start a company, and they threw out a bunch of ideas. The one that decided to go with was ski masks with beards.
Wait, what are they?
They're basically ski masks with beards attached to them. So you look like Santa Claus or ZZ Top or Saddam Hussein post-capture.
And how's the business doing?
It's doing really well. They sold out their first production run of 10,000, and they're producing more.
I didn't realize there were so many, like, kidnappers and robbers who wanted to stand out and have a little style.
George Judson, managing editor. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to talk about vending machines that can see you coming.
From where?
Well, in Japan, they've come up with a vending machine that has facial recognition. It can see who you are, what kind of person you are, and then it recommends what drink you should have.
So, like, if you look like a drunk, it'll tell you to have a beer?
Exactly.
Does it have a different voice depending on what it thinks you are? Like, if you're an old person with a hearing aid, is it like, prune juice?
Nancy Fargali, editor at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
New York City is running a contest to find its taxi of the future, and they pick three finalists, and one of the finalists is from Turkey.
I didn't realize Turkey made cars.
They do, and the coolest thing about this taxi, it has a sunroof, so you can look up and see the skyline.
That sounds nice, but for a future cab, I just want it to have a functioning air conditioner. I want it to not cost a lot of money, and I want to be able to avoid traffic. Do they have some way of doing that?
It's called the subway.
And if you like that, there is plenty more where it came from, a podcast that Rico and Brendan do called Dinner Party Download. There is a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And for now, that is Marketplace, the radio program from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 22 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ ticked up 3 points, a little more than 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, or about 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewer. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, just in time for open enrollment season, a special look at the American consumer and healthcare, including how health insurance came to be.
He is the first to offer this package deal of payment in advance for future services.
A special Marketplace Money on the road from WHYY in Philadelphia, PA. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here Monday afternoon. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.